Each year in sports, we witness amazing athletic accomplishments. Records are shattered and championships are won. And the highly paid analysts get to sit back and tell us what to think about it. Who's listening to us, the fans? This is Talk Back, where real fans engage in heated debates about the world of sports as we see it. Welcome to the show.
This week, we're going to do a quick NBA playoff recap as far as we are at this point into the the Western Conference Finals, Justin, is over, and the Eastern Conference Finals is all but over. And then we'll get into a little bit of NFL news, and then we'll hit you up with some NASCAR news with the Dale Earnhardt Jr. retirement talk. So, Justin, what's your feeling as we close out the Western Conference Finals with another sweep for the Warriors? And then where the Cavs stand, what's your take on what's going on?
I'm just glad the Western Conference is over. It felt like it was over as soon as Kawhi was hurt. It was done. The Spurs just had no answers to replace Kawhi. And even when Greg Popovich came out and had his, you know, passionate speech about Zaza and all this stuff, it just felt like it was this last cry, last ditch effort that he knew they were in trouble. And it was just, you know, let's just put this blame on Zaza because our season's over, because we just don't have the players to be able to make up for what Kawhi did for that team. And I'm just glad now that the Warriors are in the finals, because those games were on late and you're just watching blowouts. There was nothing exciting. Those games weren't even really close throughout. I mean, the Warriors just felt like they were toying with the Spurs. They were loose with the basketball, lots of turnover, sloppy play. And
did you watch all four of them that late?
I still watched most of them, unfortunately. Okay. At times I looked and said, why am I watching an 18-point Warriors game? You know, I mean, as much as I want to watch some Patrick McCall play, you know, and Kyle Anderson, it just wanted to be over, because it just felt like, let's just get the Warriors to the finals healthy. The Spurs have nothing for them. This isn't going to be a series. And I'm sure ESPN's probably glad it's over too, because it was just bad TV. It was just a horrible watch.
Yeah, and I know in next week's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the NBA lottery. And then also, as at that point, we should know if it's the Cavs or the Celtics heading out of the Eastern Conference and into the NBA Finals. So at that point, we'll wrap up a little bit of more in-depth of what happened throughout the playoffs and how the teams reset a little bit, especially as it relates to the NBA draft that's happening late in June. So we won't get too deep into the NBA this week. I mean, we kind of know where we're at. Now, the Cavs are up 3-1 at this point as we record here tonight. And I know they've got a closeout game the night, you know, that this goes live. This podcast goes live on Thursday. And at that point, yeah, I think it's going to be 4-1 Cavs. The Celtics gave them a good run in game three with LeBron being off and Kyrie and Love sort of disappearing as well in the second half. But honestly, I mean, it was a series for a little bit, a 5-minute stretch. Ultimately, the Cavaliers were never going to lose this series, I don't think.
But don't you think the Cavaliers really in game three, it was more of just an uninspired team? I mean, they were just won by 50 in Boston. I mean, how inspired are they going to be? I mean, even LeBron, rather, you know, Richard Jefferson came out today and said that, you know, the flu bug's kind of been going around the team. Darren Williams missed a shoot around and they've all just kind of been sort of lethargic and in a funk and just haven't felt well. But even when you come off of a game where you're up by 50 and that team has now lost their, by far, their best player, you're up 21 in game three.
Yeah.
I mean, how inspired do they think LeBron and these guys are going to be? You know, I mean, we just saw last night for game four where, you know, Kyrie gets the ankle injury, Love turns his ankle. I mean, the Cavs are worried about stuff like that. They are not worried about the Celtics.
Right.
You know, the Celtics just happened to get hot and they made a big comeback at them. You know, really. And it was a close game score-wise, but I didn't feel that was a great game. When you have one team that's up by 20-plus, and then the other team's cold, and then that team gets really hot, and the other team's cold, it's not a great watch. It was a great watch the last 4 or 5 minutes of the game when it was back and forth. That was fun. But even in that, I mean, it just feels like the Cavs are just sort of toying with the Celtics, and they just happen to get really hot in the second half, hit a bunch of threes. But the Cavs are so good, especially in the East. Their margin for error is just, of all the other teams, is so slim. Anything that they do, anything that happens, I mean, it's just going to be a rout. I mean, and the Cavs and Warriors have both been very fortunate with the injuries, and that sort of hurt the NBA, because I think there is an aspect where you do like a David and Goliath type, where you can get an upset, you know, you can, you know, the other team pulls it. But right now, it just feels like all the Davids, you know, are right-handed. They get their arm broke before they go play Goliath, and he just, you're just waiting for him to smash him. Right. And it, and it's been unfortunate because in every series, it seems like somebody's been hurt. Kyle Lowry's been hurt. Isaiah Thomas is now hurt. Even for the Warriors, you had Kawhi hurt. You know, Nurkic was out with a broken leg. George Hill was in and out of the lineup. These teams are so good, and they keep getting every single break. It's just like it's their destined to get to the finals versus each other.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly interested to see what happens. I think the Cavs do win in Game 5. It ends 4-1, in my opinion. And we go to the finals, and we see what's happening from there. So that's it for NBA this week. We want to break into a little bit more of NFL talk this week because, you know, we missed the NFL. The Super Bowl is already a few months away. And speaking of the Super Bowl, our good friend, the New England Patriots, there was a story out this last week. Actually, it broke when Tom Brady's wife, Giselle, was interviewed by CBS. I think the interviewer was actually Charlie Rose.
Yeah, Charlie Rose.
And she just off the cuff mentioned that Tom Brady had had a concussion this last year. And not only that, that he had been concussed several times in his 17-year career. Well, the interesting part about that, Justin, as you know, is that he's never shown up on an injury report for a head injury. And that's a big problem because the NFL is big on their concussion protocol, especially in the last 3 to 4 years. And so if he was indeed, you know, suffering from a concussion in the 2016-2017 season and it didn't show up on an injury report, that is a major problem in my eye.
Yeah, and especially because of Brady, because there was some insane streak of Belichick basically putting him on an injury report for some shoulder injury for like 8 seasons.
Sure.
And now to potentially have a concussion. Now, the one thing is that has been an issue with the NFL is the fact that sometimes players don't report it. And if they're not reporting the symptoms to the team, maybe it's just an unreported thing that they're keeping in-house. You know, he goes home, he tells Giselle, you know, I got nicked up, I'm a little foggy, I got a headache, I might have had a concussion from a hit. But he doesn't tell the team that because then it doesn't get on the injury report if the independent neurologist doesn't catch it in-game. Or he doesn't have symptoms that he's reporting, it does get hard to treat. But do the Patriots do anything that's just within league rules?
I think that's the bigger story.
It seems like every situation they find themselves, that they put themselves in the situation where it looks like they're doing something wrong. And
right.
It doesn't seem to matter. Every year it's something. And even if there's nothing there, it normally in sports, when there's smoke, there's some kind of fire. And with the Patriots, it's been proven time and time again that they seem to get themselves involved in situations that no other team in the NFL does. And this is just another example of it, that maybe it's just a story that no one cares about. It's just a passing comment. But when you have probably the most popular player in the league whose supermodel wife goes on to a CBS morning show and talks about her husband needing to retire, or she wants him to retire because he's suffered concussions and nothing has been reported, and all the stuff that NFL has pumped money into to up their concussion program and up the education to players and the need to self-report, and this isn't happening with your star, that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're absolutely right on the Patriot angle too, because you've got Spygate, you've got inflated or deflated footballs, and now you've got unreported concussions apparently. I'm a Jets fan. We've joked about it in the first 2 weeks of the podcast already. So as a Jets fan, I obviously do not root for the Patriots, but it's so bothersome that they constantly get themselves involved in this.
Yeah, and they seem to hurt their own legacy because they always put an asterisk. Yeah. They always put a cloud over it because if you're not a Patriots fan, the first thing you think is they're dirty. They're cheating. You know, as NASCAR fans, we think about that as well, where, you know, if a driver has so much more success than everyone else, and then you hear little things about, well, you know, they didn't pass this, they need to do this post-race to fix the car, the thought is that they're cheating. You know, Chad Knaus is a great example. He's been busted time after time after time. So when Jimmy keeps winning all these titles, if you're not a Jimmy Johnson fan, the thought is, well, he's cheating. And it's the same with the Patriots. Not everybody's a Patriot fan. Most people either are from Boston or displaced from Boston and love the Patriots, and everybody else hates them. And it's these clouds that keep popping up of why people hate the Patriots, because it's always something with them. And even if it's a stupid, minute story, it's still the Patriots. It's still the franchise that everybody talks about and everyone wants to be. And they just constantly have clouds that put doubt over the organization. And it's going to hurt. Eventually, something's going to happen. It's going to hurt Belichick's legacy. It's certainly going to affect Brady's legacy. It already has for a quarterback that's been suspended for four games. I mean, no one ever seems to bring that up when there's talk of, oh, is Brady greater than Montana or Manning? Like, those guys weren't suspended for breaking a league rule and lying about and destroying cell phones. You don't do that stuff if there's nothing there. And the Patriots seem to constantly be involved in it, and it just puts a cloud over them, over the league, and then everyone wants to talk about, wow, there's so much negativity. Well, what are you supposed to do? The story needs coverage. Concussions have been in the news week after week, year after year now, really since the, you know, the retired players filed the lawsuit, and they've just pumped millions and millions of dollars into this program, and now you have the elite team with the face of the NFL, and this story, it's going to get traction.
I think it has to. And, you know, just yesterday, the NFL broke more news that they were going to have some rule changes going into the 2017-2018 season, this season, regarding the length of time in overtime.
Ugh.
They're going to reduce it from 15 minutes to 10 minutes. Now, we want to talk about that a little bit, because the way that they presented that, the way the league presented that to the owners at the spring meetings, was all surrounding player safety. And so, you know, how can you have a guy like Tom Brady, whose wife admits in an interview that he's had concussions even within the last year, and the NFL, I think they have to either investigate that or look into it, or at least punish the Patriots in some way for their reporting. So regarding the overtime rules, yeah, they're reducing it from 15 to 10 minutes, all under the guise of this safety protocol, right? But I think that's just absurdly ridiculous because, well, for a number of reasons, they want to have their cake and eat it too. There is, in their statistics, most overtimes last an average of 7 minutes and 43 seconds. And they're using that as a sort of a selling point to the owners that, well, the average overtime only lasts 7 minutes anyway, so let's just cut the last 5 minutes off because most of the time we don't go that far. So it's going to save, but then they, in the other side of their mouth, they say it's going to save all these injuries by cutting 5 minutes off. Well, you just told us that it barely ever goes that far. So then what's the difference if you cut it off or not? You're not, you know, it's all fake.
Don't you feel like as a fan, sometimes the NFL is just, they treat you like you're a toddler. They're like, well, you know, the fans are not very intelligent, so we'll just tell them whatever we want and we'll just sell it and we'll make it sound good. We'll tell them it's for player safety. Oh, that'll make them feel good. And then they say, hey, you know what? We should add two regular season games because, you know, weeks 15, 16, and 17 are so great anyways. Let's add two more weeks to get to 18 games. Let's add another playoff team because we're so worried about player safety.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Thursday night games. Thursday night games are atrocious. You got guys playing, you know, you literally have teams playing sometimes late on a Sunday night. They go back. They have a walkthrough Monday, walkthrough Tuesday. And then on Wednesday afternoon, they're on a jet flying to a different time zone to play in a game the next day. And they want to talk about player safety. It's the stupidest way logic that the NFL has to try to sell things because they don't care about player safety. They care about money. They care about selling tickets. They care about their product. They care about their TV partners. It's all about money. And they try to put player safety as the face of it, but it has nothing to do with it. 5 minutes of overtime, that's really going to, you know, they think that's going to save a ton of injuries. It's just ridiculous. I mean, there's different ways that they could come up with schemes in overtime. I mean, they could give teams, you know, each team gets one possession. If they both tie, then you do something like the college rules or there's other things that they could do because how many of these games are going to end in ties now?
I have the answer to that question, actually. I'm glad you asked. So in the last 5 years, the actual stat is there has been five ties, which is an average of only one tie per year. So once again, the NFL says, well, most overtimes last an average of 7 minutes. It's not going to increase the amount of ties. Well, if you take in the last 5 years, the overtime from 15 minutes to 10 minutes, you actually, instead of having five ties in the last 5 years, you get 16 ties in the last 5 years. And that dynamic changes the playoffs. It changes the seeding. It changes everything. So they cannot say that this doesn't make that much of a difference in the gameplay and then find out that you have 11 more ties in the last 5 years, which absolutely changes the dynamic of the playoffs.
I just think as a fan, if you sit for four and a half hours, even on TV, or if you're a fan and you take the time to go to a game, or God forbid you're a fan, you know, and fly across the country to go watch a tie and spend hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars with a hotel and airfare and tickets to watch your team tie. It's just ridiculous logic that this is what they've come up with. Oh, we're going to shorten it to 10 minutes. And it just feels like there's so many different ways that they could go about this. they could give each team one possession if you get inside the 35 or something. You can't kick a field goal or you have to go for it on fourth. They could do something so each team could get one possession and they have to capitalize on it. So you get a, you know, you get a winner and you get a loser. I don't think that, you know, Vince Lombardi and these guys would have said like, oh, let's just, you know, they would have been happy with these rules. And we just seem to be, they just seem to be giving us whatever. And because we're NFL fans, we're just going to gobble it up like they do everything else. And it's just ridiculous and absurd. And the NFL just keeps coming up with more and more just idiotic rules that make no sense for the fans.
So what, let me ask you this. What is the disadvantage of the NFL going to the college system where each team gets a possession and you start at, you know, a certain yard line and the NFL could change it to be whatever yard line they want it to be, whether they want to push it back just slightly to the 45 or 40 or whatever the case may be, but give each team the offensive possession, but from a short field. I think you're going to get quick scoring. Your overtimes are going to organically be shorter. And so if it's a player safety issue, as they say it is, you're going to reduce the clock anyway, because in college, I think the overtimes are quite quick. One, I mean, sometimes you get those crazy five OT type of games, but that's rare. And generally it's settled in one or two trips down. It takes 5 minutes and the NFL could, why can't they do the same thing?
I totally agree. I've obviously, you know, we've both, years after years, listen to a lot of sports talk radio and things, and I always hear these guys like just bash the college rule, and I'm like, I don't see the issue with it. I think it's an exciting rule to have in there.
As a fan, I love it.
I mean, other sports have changes to, you know, soccer has penalty kicks, you know, hockey has shootouts, you know, basketball reduces theirs to 5 minutes, you know, but it's set. They don't constantly want to change it. You know, they don't change the shot clock or do anything crazy. They just keep playing till there's a winner. What difference does it make if you sort of change? You're trying to reduce the number of plays on these guys. That's what what they're really looking for. It's not more of a time issue. It's just more of the number of plays. So if you shorten the field and you have quicker scores and, you know, the first team gets the ball and they kick a field goal and the second team gets it, they can get it in, the game's over. And, you know, maybe the players have, you know, five or six extra plays on them. It's not going to keep going and going and going. And even college has it, I think, after the second score, they have to go for two.
Right.
I mean, you could have it, they have to go for two on every single time if you're trying to reduce it. There's other ways that they could fix this problem and make the game exciting. But they keep, you know, well, let's take the kickoffs out because it's so dangerous. Well, then let's add two more games. Let's do this. Let's do that. They talk, you're exactly right. They talk out both sides of their mouth. They want their cake. They want to eat it too. They keep trying to make these PR moves to try to sell fans that everything they do is for player safety. Everything they do is not for player safety. Remember, they have TV partners. So when you have a 1 o'clock game, they've already pushed the afternoon game back to 4:25 because that's where you get Fox's, you know, America's Game of the Week. They want to get their TV audience time to finish up the 1 o'clock game and then get to the 4 o'clock game. So they're thinking about that as well, where they don't want to waste the other network's 4 o'clock audience. So they're thinking about that stuff too. I think it's probably more about that than it is about anything else in terms of player safety.
Yeah. And you know what made me laugh is Goodell is quoted as saying that one of his concerns was a Sunday afternoon game, or even worse, the Sunday evening game, going into overtime, and then one of those two teams that are in that contest having to play that Thursday. Well, that problem is a whole different issue to begin with. You should never have your team playing on Sunday and then on Thursday if you really care about player safety. In fact, you and I were talking today and you had an interesting thought on the Thursday night situation, which I thought was a pretty interesting idea and a good idea. Just share quickly what you thought about that.
Well, I just think I don't understand why the league just doesn't add a second bye weekend. And right now they open up really, it seems like they open up that second weekend in September. It seems always be now around September 11th, sometime in there is the game. I don't understand why they just don't open the season on Labor Day weekend. You have that Sunday, you know, people could...
I feel like it used to be earlier,
too. Yeah, people could sort of do whatever they want to do. They have that Monday off. It seems like it would be the perfect time to come out and make that your launch point. You know, you could open your season still on Thursday night. You basically back the season up 1 week, and then if you're a team that plays on Thursday, you have the week before that off. So you play your Sunday game, you're off that week, and then you play the next Thursday. And then you basically come into that game with, you know, 11, 12 days rest. After that game, you get another 10 days of rest. You give your players a chance to rest. You give them a chance to heal up. I feel like it would make a lot of sense. They get their extra week built in because you're already going to have more games. They can manipulate the schedule however they need to. And they get to sort of brand that Labor Day weekend and take that over as theirs. I mean, the NFL, all they have to do is I mean, please don't tell me that Labor Day is more important than Thanksgiving or Christmas, where the NFL just puts games, whatever. You know, if Christmas Day hits on a Sunday, we're going to play on Christmas Day. Right, and the right. fans will still watch. They have three games on Thanksgiving Day. People work around that. I mean, don't tell me that Labor Day is more important than that. I mean, they could easily do that, and it would be the perfect situation. Everybody talks about the Super Bowl. Oh, we, you know, Monday should be a national holiday, or line it up with President's Day so people have that Monday off. They could brand that opening weekend as, you know, stay up, watch football late, you know, put two games on Sunday night or something for opening week, like they do with Monday, and have it be a later game, and people wouldn't mind on the East Coast staying up till, you know, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning to watch the end of a game because Monday they're off.
Right. Yeah.
So it just seems like it makes a lot of sense if they're going to spend all this money on Thursday night. They have, you know, Amazon's streaming the Thursday night games, and it's on CBS and NBC, and they want these guys to have their number one teams doing them. You know, like Mike Tirico couldn't even do the games last year because they had to have Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth because they wanted Thursday night to be something special. Well, then make it something special where teams actually have a chance to game plan. And then get some marquee matchups and make Thursday night something special. Don't keep giving us Jacksonville and Tennessee and the Buccaneers and the Panthers and these teams that no one really outside their regions care about. Get some good marquee matchups in there. Give them time, and they will see that product take off. And they will make all the money that they want because it'll be a product people want to see, just like Sunday night is, just like Monday night is. But you don't get that with a Thursday night game. You get vanilla game plans. You get guys that are hurt. It's just horrible package. I can't believe that they've spent billions of dollars on this because it's just a horrible product. And it just seems like a very easy fix to move it back, rebrand it. The NFL would make, I don't know how many more millions off of having an extra week to they could go back through and renegotiate with their TV partners. It just seems like it would make a lot of sense to be able to just do that and start it. I mean, really, they could start it as early as they wanted to. I mean, but certainly not maybe this coming season, but the next season they could have that and sort of rebrand their Thursday package. It just seems like it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and the whole idea of adding a week, you know, 17 or 18 and extra weeks was this whole notion that they want the season to extend out as long as possible because of that TV revenue and because NFL fans, as compared to NBA, MLB, et cetera, are traditionally a bigger audience and will be more loyal to watching games on television. So, extend the season through better scheduling and those types of things. So, the other thing they changed this week, which I actually liked, and I've been frustrated for the past few years as the refs have tried to figure out how to legislate celebrations, and the league has become known as the No Fun League. I'm actually pretty excited to announce, not that I'm announcing it, the NFL announced it, but that I'm announcing to our listeners, if they haven't heard, that they are reinstituting the allowance of celebrations. Now, you can't go in there and twerk, you know, you can't be doing that. But you can do three main things that they took out previously, which is to use the ball as a prop, to have a team demonstration. And then also you can go to the ground. And when we say go to the ground, what does that mean? Well, we've seen guys make snow angels and, perform CPR on the football, laying on the ground and things like that. Who was it that went into the fetal position a couple years ago? You know, look, my take on this is that I looked at average ticket prices just for last season, and the lowest, average ticket for any team was the Jacksonville Jaguars at $61.
Shocker.
Not surprising there. The highest average ticket was the New England Patriots at $131.
Shysters.
Again, either no shocker there or shysters, whichever way you want to look at it. Because Tom Brady's always on the field because he doesn't report injuries. And so obviously the mean of that is somewhere around $93. So let's say, you know, fans to go to any NFL game and get a seat, it's going to be $93. Now, if you take your family, all of a sudden now you're talking $400 to $500. That doesn't include food, parking, possible hotels, etc. It can be between a $600 to $800 event for a family. Now, for me, that's half of a vacation. So I don't go to NFL games on a regular basis. Why in the world, over the past 5 years, did they legislate fun out of the game? I never understood that. So I'm really actually glad that they're putting fun back in terms of celebrations. I know some folks in my family that watch NFL with me, a bit more of an old school approach. They hate it. They think it's very, some people just think it's too pop culture. It's too, disrespectful, whatever. Now the NFL does say you can't do anything that's crude or anything like that. And you also can't do anything that's taunting the other team. So your demonstration can't be specifically in the face of another team or that type of thing.
Or pretend the ball is a weapon or that you have one.
Oh, yes. And then you can't pretend it's a weapon. That's true. Other than that, the players are actually, I really enjoy watching their creativity and the celebration. And I also just think it's a very, sports are emotional. And the thing that really also gets me is that it's entertainment. At the end of the day, sports is entertainment. These guys are employed by billion-dollar leagues to put on a show and entertain us. Why we're taking out these celebrations, I don't know.
It never made sense to me why they did it, because most of their marketing partners would always put the whatever the new dance or whatever the celebration was the week before or in the season. You would always see that somehow in a commercial, in a, you know, a pre-game type of package they would put together in the B-roll that you're watching, you know, while you're watching SportsCenter, you're watching that type of stuff. It always seemed like it was a very marketable trait, and it made their players more marketable. I mean, look at Chad Johnson's career just based on his celebrations. Most people look at that far more than they ever looked at his stats, as good of a wide receiver as he was. Terrell Owens the same way. It just seemed like, why would the NFL want to take something out that drew fans in? There had to be more people that liked this that didn't.
Sure, I agree with that.
And it, you know, it seemed like, what were they trying to cater to? What were they trying to prove? You know, you can put things on there if you don't want sexual type of moves or weapons or things. You can write that into the, you know, the bylaws of this and tell the players. And you just make it a significant penalty if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make them kick the ball out of their own end zone or something. Make it so that their team comes down on them if they do something that you don't want. You know, make the penalties harsh if they step over the line. But if not, let the guys have fun, because you need to get the younger demographics to continue to watch the sport. And like you said, they are pricing out so many different people from actually physically going to the game. They need to heavily rely on their TV audience. And that has even slipped, because you saw when there was other things people could watch, they tended to watch it last year in the beginning of the year. So I never understood why they did it. I always enjoyed that part of the game. If you're a player on the field and you don't want to see it, well, then don't let the guy score. If you don't like Cam Newton's dance, don't let him punch it in from the goal line, because you know he's going to dance. It's just that simple. I mean, everybody can do it. You know, players dance after sacks. Players dance after knocking the ball down. They jump after a 3-yard catch for a first down. It's just part of the game. And like you said, sometimes for guys, it's just unbridled joy. They're just excited. They're emotional. They want to do something. If players want to come up with something creative as a team and have a choreographer and go all out, I mean, go for it. Who cares? I mean, some of that. And again, the NFL was the biggest marketer of that when it was happening. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like there was a little bit of negative feedback as Twitter started to get going. Some of the, you know, get out of my lawn type fans that didn't like it. And it's just like they made a rash move to stop it. But I mean, you know, didn't Pepsi just do a commercial this year with Antonio Brown, like, dancing in the corner? And you know, it makes players more marketable. It makes the league more marketable. It gives more juice to the sponsors of how they can use players, how they can integrate them. It just seems like it's a win-win for everyone. So I'm glad that they did it. That's probably one of the good things they did. I'm surprised that they don't have some safety rule built into it of certain things they can't do because you may
not get a concussion while you're celebrating.
Yeah, you can't give another player a concussion, or they may cut out like headbutts before the game or something like that. You know, who knows what the crazy thing the NFL do, but at least this one, it seems like they're going in the right direction to bring some fun and entertainment value back into a game. And maybe the ratings last year got to them. Maybe it scared them early on when, you know, they were way off, because they just had dumb stuff like this. I mean, just like the catch rule. Like, when you can't watch a game and understand what a catch is, much less understand, like, oh, well, that guy went to the ground, that's 15 yards, and, oh, that guy didn't, so it's not. It brings elements to the game that just confuse people and just anger fans. Sure. So I'm glad that they actually made this rule change, because hopefully it will bring some excitement back to the game and you can get rid of all these stupid celebration penalties.
Thank you.
All right. So you and I are both NASCAR fans, and me, I'm a Dale Earnhardt Jr. fan. I have been for a long time. So the news broke recently that he was going to retire. Now, he made that announcement after the season was already started, but through some consultation with Rick Hendrick, his team owner. And I was surprised when I heard the news, but also not surprised. But after hearing Junior talk about it on his podcast on Dirty Mo Radio, the Dale Jr. Download, which is very good, by the way, I understood his position. And one of the lines that he said that really got to me from an emotional standpoint, from a fan standpoint, is last year when he had the concussion situation, and a lot of people don't realize unless they've read the in-depth articles about that process, is his recovery after that happened was pretty hard, actually. And there was a good number of weeks where he never even thought he would race again. And so I know he said on the podcast, his podcast, that I wanted to retire from racing rather than having racing retire me. And so I think him and Amy decided, his wife Amy decided, that they would give one more year to this this NASCAR racing career. And obviously over the first 2 months of the season, him and Rick Hendrick had many discussions about that and came to the conclusion that this would indeed be his last year. And so he announced that to the fans recently. Justin, what's your thoughts on that?
I wasn't surprised. It felt like in listening to his podcast and some of his interviews, and again, like you alluded to, all that he went through last year just to get back into the car, it just, I thought he would be maybe 2 years. I thought he would run this year, maybe next year, and then get out of the car and try to give Hendrick maybe a bridge to get to William Byron, see how he did into the Xfinity series and just have a driver ready to go. But I'm not really surprised because, I think it was a wake-up call that what they do is very dangerous. It's easy to forget that because there's so many horrible things and wrecks that we see in the guys and even, gals in terms of Danica just get out of the car with no issue and you sort of forget what they're doing. And even some of the wrecks he's had haven't necessarily looked like bad wrecks, but it's just that whip effect where I think it's just, he really knows that, anything that happens could potentially cause him to have a concussion. He would have to go all the way back through this process. And again, he's recently gotten married. They're talking about wanting to have a family, as both of us have families and kids, and we know how that can change your life. And a lot of that is just like, what else is he going to accomplish? The risk of injury versus what else is left to accomplish for a guy that's probably got enough money for his kids to spend. He doesn't need to do that. He can still be around racing with his team. I would not be shocked if he ended up doing some kind of broadcasting. He seems to be very good at that, very natural at it. The sport would certainly like to keep him around in the capacity they have Jeff Gordon, have him at the racetrack every week, have him doing appearances, have him on TV to try to be at least, for a few years to be a bridge so they get their young stars more marketable and for fans to get behind them. But, certainly it's definitely sad to see so many good drivers over the last few years that have gone. As a Tony Stewart fan, you could kind of feel that his time was coming where just racing, it just didn't feel like he was into it that much. And Junior, it's sort of getting that way too, where you can tell he's frustrated. The car isn't where he wants it to be. The team's not where they want it to be. They seem a little bit lost. That's frustrating for him because, it seems like he does want to have a better season, but at the same time, it's just like they're involved in a lot of stuff. He's got a lot of longer term plans and, I just think it's probably the right time for him to get out. But as a fan, it's hard to see Jeff Gordon and Tony Stewart and Dale Jr. and even Carl Edwards, four top drivers, just walk away from the sport. And you start to wonder and you start looking through the list that there could be a lot more in the next few years that continue to leave the sport. And you sort of wonder, what's going to happen with NASCAR.
Yeah. And, I know from talking to some of my other friends who are NASCAR fans, they maybe don't like Dale Earnhardt Jr. as much. They feel like he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth or this was always going to be his destiny. And I would encourage them to actually research what they're talking about because he actually needed to seek his father's approval constantly when he was growing up. And racing was Dale Sr.'s main thing. His kids were kind of secondary for a lot of their growing up years until Dale Sr. realized that Dale Jr. was really longing for that relationship with him, sort of almost in his preteen years. Jr. wanted to race anything he could get his hands on a steering wheel, and that's when Sr. really started to notice. And these are Dale's words, not mine. And so he was not just sort of ushered into this career. He had to earn it as well. He had to earn his father's approval. He wasn't just given everything. So in my eyes, Dale Earnhardt Jr. actually leaves the sport, whether he wins a championship this year or not, which would give him either zero or one championships. We have to remember he's a two-time Busch Series champion prior to entering the Cup Series. So he is a champion. He's also a two-time Daytona 500 champion in 2004 and in 2014. He does have 26 wins, but this is the one that I think people overlook. 253 top tens in his career, which out of 606 starts. So that represents 42% of the time he finishes in the top 10. I think that's pretty darn respectable. Yeah. And so I'm very concerned. You know, he's also won most popular driver for the last 14 years. So you brought it up, and I think it's a perfect point that in the last 3 years, we lose Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, and Dale Earnhardt Jr., as well as Carl Edwards. And where do we think NASCAR goes from here? Who rises to fill or to sort of save the sport? Because we're going to talk about in just a second here, we want to touch on it briefly, that NASCAR's attendance is in a bad way right now. They've got TV deals upcoming and then expiring in the next 5 years. And they're in a bit of a bad spot. Part of that, I think, is the Jeff Gordon retirement and then the Tony Stewart retirement. But with Jeff Gordon and Dale Earnhardt Jr., those two drivers alone probably represented a good 75% of the NASCAR faithful of the last 15 to 20 years, and now they're both going away. How does NASCAR recover from that?
I don't think I have the answer, and I'm pretty sure NASCAR doesn't have the answer, because I think in Dale Jr.'s case anyways, what made him appealing to fans is he just seemed like that, just kind of the everyday man. You know, even if you listen to his podcast, he talks about going to Taco Bell and just kind of doing like random stuff that like fans do. And he talks about, you know, how he's tries to be approachable. And you really feel that come out of him where, as people have been to races, you know, I've watched, you know, drivers just bolt down pit road, not pay any attention to some of the fans. And I think that leaves a bad image. You know, it makes the driver seem like they're on a pedestal. And with Junior, just never felt like that. And I feel like that's why his fan base was so big. And that's what was so appealing to him was, you know, and even like you said, when people think he had a silver spoon in his mouth, I think if you research him, he's the complete opposite of that. You know, he just kind of came into the sport. He was a young guy. He just wanted to drive and party early on. He talked about that. And then he sort of has changed and evolved over the years to a guy, if you really listen to him, that he really cares about letting his fans down if he doesn't drive well. And that really weighs on him, that he really cares about. And I think his fans feel that. And I think there's going to be a big hole there left, because even with Jeff Gordon's fans, they put Chase Elliott into that 24 car and he's been competitive. So they've actually had a bridge over to him. He's a young guy. He's with Hendrick. Jeff Gordon's kind of been sort of a mentor there. It seems like he's around him a lot.
And he's Bill Elliott's son, which I think helps, because the Jeff Gordon sort of overlapped the Bill Elliott era. And for some of those fans, it could be just a natural, well, I know Bill Elliott. I can follow Chase
Elliott. Especially like the older fans that like Bill Elliott, they've kind of been lost since then of who to like. You know, it's a nice bridge where you have your younger Jeff Gordon fans, you have some older fans. You know, Chase a very likable guy, and how hard he is on himself when he doesn't have success. So I think there's there, and I think there's a lot of young drivers and young talent, and they themselves seem to be doing a pretty good job on social media. You know, you look at Ryan Blaney, Bubba Wallace, some of the goofy stuff they're doing on Twitter. It seems like Fox or NBC, they need to make like segments or things like that in the pre-race show, even if they're like just 5 minute segments, just to get these guys out to the public to see. And then let the public see their talent on the racetrack and then start to try to build up that way. And if these guys become popular enough, then the national media will start to pick them up. You know, late night shows will do stuff. They can do the New York media tours and people will know who they are. And they won't be able to just be like, who the heck is this guy? There'll be enough following there where people will actually care. But it seems like NASCAR needs to do a better job of getting guys like Kyle Larson and Ryan Blaney and Chase Elliott and even Erik Jones and Daniel Suarez, some of these young guys, get them out there into the public spotlight. You know, have them do stuff with some of the older drivers, you know, kind of try to make a bridge together. And then, you know, there's got to be a way to do stuff, even if they bring some retired drivers in, things like that, something to help bridge this gap of what's going on with NASCAR, because there's a lot of young talent, but I don't think that they're enough to like draw fans into it yet. I mean, you know, we're going to get into the All-Star race, but even in that open, you know, you had Suarez, you had Chase Elliott, you had Erik Jones. Erik Jones like driving through the grass to get there.
It was,
you know,
awesome.
That's stuff that we, it's legendary that even like Earnhardt did with the pass in the grass. It wasn't really a pass, but it's stuff that gets talked about a lot. And this will probably get lost in the evening, but these guys have that kind of talent. I think NASCAR just has to do a better job of marketing them, helping them have a better social media presence as well. If they don't, and get these guys out there and help them work on their image of like, look, take a few minutes when there's fans around and stop. Even if you just do it for three or four people, even if it's just kids, do something to show that you care about the fans. Because if you don't do that, it's everything they do is never going to work, because the image will be, well, this guy just does stuff for TV. He's not genuine. That's what they're going to miss, I think, the most with Dale Jr. They have to be able to find that.
Yeah, and why is this such a big deal to us? Well, for one, we're huge NASCAR fans. But two, take this last weekend, the NASCAR All-Star race at Charlotte Motor Speedway. And you also have, that's Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s last All-Star race. So you would think there was some appeal there from a fan perspective. And this was the lowest watched All-Star race in nearly the last 20 years. I think they said the year 2000 was a little bit lower than this one. But overall admissions are down 30% in the last 8 years. And that's not just for the All-Star race, but that's overall through the season. 30% in the last 8 years, admissions are down. This year, they have a new title sponsor, Monster Energy. And Monster Energy is paying $20 million a year to be the title sponsor. And Sprint, previous to them, was paying $50 million a year. Now, from a numbers perspective, that's valuation, right? So if they were $50 million valued company and we're on Shark Tank and the sharks say, well, I'll give you $20 million to be your sponsor, that's a problem. You just lost $30 million annually. And that's I think it's an indicator that Monster Energy wouldn't see $50 million of value there. They might see $20 million, but they don't see $50. And obviously Sprint didn't see $50 anymore because they left. And, you know, then you've got these other news stories where NBC came out and asked for, you know, a better deal, better marketing, things like that for their current deal. Because NBC's deal was a $4.4 billion deal that runs through 2023. Now, Fox, they're going to be up sooner. They're going to be up in 2020 in just three seasons. And they were on a $2.4 billion deal. What does all this mean? Even for our listeners who aren't deep into the NASCAR scene like we are, what does this all mean? Well, it means that there's a problem. It means that the fan base is dropping off. It may be for probably a number of reasons that we can speculate, one being the change from the traditional points to the chase over the last little bit more than a decade. And, you know, some of your traditional fans just didn't like that transition. And then NASCAR continues to tweak and change the rules every other year. That bothers people as well. But Junior is not gone yet. And the numbers are looking like this. When he leaves, if the numbers drop even further, these TV deals that are up in 2020 and 2023 are going to be, the new ones are going to be minuscule compared to these deals. And that's a big problem.
It is a huge problem, because when you look at just the title sponsor, like you said, how it's dropped, NASCAR got very fortunate that in the time their TV deals were up, had Fox Sports was trying to kick, you know, FS1 off. NBC was trying to get NBC Sports Network off the ground. They wanted,
that's a good point,
programming, so they overpaid for NASCAR because they couldn't get basically NFL or NBA. They couldn't buy into that and beat ESPN or TNT even for an NBA package. So they got very fortunate to probably get, I would say, way overpaid even at the time the deal was done, because NASCAR had these issues years ago. Just no one in the sport wanted to address them. And we could probably do a whole podcast on the issues with NASCAR, but it's just the perfect storm just seemed to hit NASCAR. You know, when the country kind of went through their recession, the fan base that was probably hurt the most out of all the sports was NASCAR, a more blue collar fan base, you know, and even as NASCAR fans have, or as NASCAR's the tracks have done things to lower prices to try to get fans in. I think basically what fans saw was when they didn't have it, they found other things to do and they really weren't missing anything. We watch the NFL. I always think of, why is the NFL so popular? Well, you have fantasy sports and you just have the water cooler aspect of it. Like, you don't want to be the one guy that's left out. If you're group texting with your buddies, like, oh my gosh, did you see the Odell Beckham catch? Like, no, hold on. I got to go on Twitter and try to find the video of it. Like, you want to see things happen in the moment so that you can be part of that. With NASCAR, it feels like it goes so long where you see nothing that's of substance. You just see a lot of boring races, which is why they tried to fix with the stages this year. But there wasn't a lot of events through a season that you felt was like water cooler talk. And it felt like it's gotten worse and worse as the racing has gotten. There's no rivalries left. It's just kind of been the perfect storm over the last 10 years. That's just a lot of things, not just one, that's pulled the sport down. And like you said, they're having all these issues. They were having these issues when they had their stars. When they had Jeff Gordon, when they had Tony Stewart, when they had Dale Jr., it's just progressively gotten worse. And I think it's going to continue to get worse because NASCAR just continues to tinker and change everything, and they just keep losing more and more and more fans because people get tired of trying to keep up with the rules. Even as big of fans as we are, we had to text each other for weeks trying to figure out what the heck they were going to do with these stages and who got points. We try to run our own fantasy NASCAR, and we had to have like conference calls to figure out how the heck we were going to do it. And my poor dad has no clue what he's doing and how the points are. And you start to think about the fan base that's, you know, not as social media driven, like that they're trying to keep up with all this stuff. And every time they get a hold of it, NASCAR changes it again. And then they're losing drivers. And it's a perfect storm. Like I said, there's enough stuff that we could have an entire podcast to talk about what has happened with NASCAR and what the heck they need to do to try to fix it. But the big problem they have is, I, as a fan, I'm worried when their TV deals are up of what is going to happen, because they are bleeding teams every year. They've already reduced their field sizes. They have trouble getting even 40 cars to the racetrack. 10 of those aren't even competitive race cars, and that's probably being generous. What is going to happen when you start reducing purses, when the tracks aren't getting as much money and they're already losing money, and they get a big chunk, I believe they get 65% or so of that TV deal money goes to the racetracks to help pay for purses and things like that. What if that money gets cut in half? Like, how is the sport going to survive? They already can't keep sponsorships. The prices of just their equipment and everything they're trying to do keeps going up. You know, if, and 50% might be again, another generous number. If you look at how much it dropped from the Sprint deal to the Monster deal, you know, if it drops that much on the TV deal side in 5 years, I'm worried about what's going to happen to the sport. I'm already worried about the truck series. You have Red Horse Racing just this week. That's been a team that's been in the sport for well over 10 years. Just closed the doors.
Yeah, and a good driver, Timothy Peters.
Two trucks.
All of a sudden, unemployed.
6th and 10th in points, and they're done.
They're done. Yeah.
And you start to wonder.
It's pretty sad, actually.
The trucks can barely get 30 to the racetrack. What are they going to do when they can't get 25 trucks or 20? What's going to happen to that series? As good as it is, I just worry about the long-term viability of this sport, because it seems like it costs a lot of money. I mean, the joke is always, how do you make a little bit of money in NASCAR? You start with a lot. And that's a scary business principle for people, that they can spend all this money. I mean, it's going to be a lot of millionaires and billionaires that better love racing for this sport to survive. If not, I think it's going to be in big trouble.
So, Justin, you and I had the opportunity to play golf together recently, and it got me thinking, what is the funniest thing you've ever seen on a golf course while playing golf?
Well, anytime somebody hits a house, that's always pretty funny. My poor dad rolled down a hill the other day, and once he was okay, it was a little scary first, but that was pretty funny. Because it kind of reminded me of the scene in Black Sheep where Chris Farley rolls down the hill and he grabs a little tree branch and it eventually snaps and he keeps rolling. So I was kind of thinking that. But I know at one point years ago, I had a friend that hit a house, and then my dad pretended that he was the homeowner and called my friend on his phone from a caller ID blocked and scared him to death for like a half a day, thinking he was going to get sued or arrested. So that was kind of a funny event that happened. But I'd say anytime that you hear a ball and you hear some expletives, and then you just stand there and wait, and you hear the off the house, It's always a pretty funny sound, as long as it's not a cracking or a window
a
break.
Shatter, yeah.
Yeah, it's always pretty funny.
I tell you what got me thinking about that question is and I could actually do a whole podcast on funny things I've done on the golf course in my years. My dad could tell a ton of stories of immature things I've done on the golf course. But the other day, I was playing golf in an outing with a gentleman who doesn't play golf very often, and he did something I have not seen in my entire life, which was hit a ball behind him. Not only did he hit it behind him.
On purpose?
No, definitely not on purpose. He is standing in the fairway with a 3-wood in his hand. It's a second shot on a par 5. He comes down on the ball. He hits the top of the ball so hard that the ball actually goes down into the ground. But because he was swinging a 3-wood with such force, it didn't stay in the ground. It didn't embed in the ground. It actually popped up, straight up, went over his head and landed. It was actually slightly raining that day. It landed in the hood of his rain jacket. The ball landed in this freaking hood of his rain jacket. I have never seen anything like that in my life. I couldn't hit my shot for 5 minutes because I was laughing so hard.
Yeah, you might want to get that guy some football equipment or a helmet or that sounds dangerous. That does not sound like a sport that he might want to invest a lot of money or time in. Just get out of that before you hurt yourself or hurt someone else. All right, so my question for you is NASCAR just released their 2018 schedule, so they made some changes. So when you think about the Chase now, it has Richmond in it, it has Vegas in it. But if you were running NASCAR, what is at least one track you would like to see it in the Chase?
I'd have to put Watkins Glen in the Chase.
Okay.
I know that gets a little difficult because that track is in New York, and you have the potential for weather to be a problem in the fall if you get too late. But I think if they made that, you know, a race in one of the first segments of the Chase.
Yeah, September.
I mean, I think that's completely viable. But not only is it a road course, but it's a really fast road course. It's a road course that the drivers, I think it's a road course that they really enjoy. Not that they don't enjoy Sonoma, but Watkins Glen, because of its speed and slightly different style, I think they really enjoy it. I just think you need to have a road course in the Chase. And if I had to pick one of the choices that we have, now there's other great road courses all across the country that they don't use. I would put Watkins Glen in there.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I like the road course aspect. I mean, they have two in the regular season, you know, so you talk about two out of 26. So, you know, why not have one out of 10 be a different kind of road course, especially early on in the Chase? I like that a lot. What's your thoughts on the Charlotte possibly going to the Roval? It seems like that's mixed reviews, but it seems like it's not going to be the road course racing that we like, a little bit of the double file restarts, a little beating and banging, cars kind of stay close. It seems like this is going to allow them to get spread out, or at least that's what some of the drivers, especially Dale Jr., had talked about, that it might not be, again, it might be getting sold something that's going to disappoint the fans.
Sure. I love the idea. I'm familiar with the Roval because of NASCAR video games. I've had the opportunity to drive a video game car on the Charlotte Roval. And when we say Roval, just so people know, it's a road course and it uses part of the oval. The problem with Charlotte, well, two things. One, if Dale Jr. talks or another driver talks, I listen, because those guys, they know what they're talking about.
You have to.
Yeah. I mean, so start there, first of all. And I think his viewpoint is valid. He's saying that 90% of the Roval is still the oval, whereas that you take a 10% segment of the front stretch and then you go inside the racetrack and do a whole bunch of road course racing, and then you come back out onto the front stretch and continue on, and you use all of the turns and then all of the back stretch and most of turns three and four. So yeah, I am very intrigued, and I love the idea of them trying it. Here's what the risk is. It sucks. I mean, that's the risk, that it sucks. Because you know what that leads to? Yet another change.
Another change. And another thing with NASCAR is it seems like every time that the spotlight is on them, something happens to just mess it up. Either, you know, even after the Kyle and Joey run in, you know, you might get some more eyeballs and it's a boring race. Or something happens and there's a rain out. Or something, we trump up the all-star race and it's a boring race. That's my fear with this, is they're gonna pump this thing up and it's gonna be another bore fest. and fans are going to get disappointed, and it's going to be more fans lost to this. Probably the best track they've ever put in and hyped up was, to my opinion, was Eldora with the dirt race.
Yeah.
Because at least it's something different, and every time they put on a great show. So if they do put the Roval in at Charlotte and use that road course, I hope they're cautious with it, or at least that they don't build it up so much to the point that it actually backfires on them.
Right, yeah, because another scheduling change they made is that they took the final race of the regular season away from Richmond and gave it to Indianapolis. Now, that might seem like a good idea, but Indianapolis has been struggling to put on good races, and they're also struggling to sell tickets. So in NASCAR's infinite wisdom, they thought, oh, let's take a race that's really struggling and put it at race 26 to be the capper of the season, and it could be terrible.
It could kill all the momentum going into the chase.
I mean,
if it's an absolute, you know,
Richmond wasn't broken, why fix it?
You know, I like the fact of getting two short tracks into the chase. I think that's a good aspect. But I think if you go into the chase where you've just had a car that goes out and dominates and runs off, and you're basically relying on your stages or segments or whatever they're calling them to bring your cautions out and get the field back together, that's a dangerous principle too. Because at least with Richmond, and even that race, you know, a lot of the guys are locked in. You only have a few guys racing for spots. That race can even get boring on a short track, much less if you put it at Indy, that's already struggled from a competition standpoint to put on good shows. I mean, that's a risky play. I mean, obviously, as NASCAR fans, we hope it works out, but whew, I don't know who's making these decisions. But, I mean, does NASCAR have drug testing?
They might want to test Brian France and those other guys. Yeah, it's a big problem that they need to figure out how to listen to fans. I mean, this is why we keep saying this on this podcast. Stop listening to yourselves, your executives, your powers that be. Listen to the fans, and you might actually learn something.
And stop listening to the 10 people on Twitter that don't like something that you do, and then you freak out, and then you change it, and it messes it up for your existing fans that maybe like what you do and just don't want to take the time to go out and complain about it. You know, like you said, get a fan council. Do more with that kind of stuff. You know, poll people on Twitter that follow you. Get a bigger audience. You know, in the medical field, if you don't have a big enough study and you can't power it properly, you can't show different statistical aspects of it. It's the same with NASCAR. You can't poll 20 people on Twitter that are all complaining about what you do because that's all they have time to do and think they speak for everybody. Just listen to NASCAR, their Sirius XM. It's always the people that call in that want to complain about something. It's not the people that actually like it. If I like something, why am I going to call in to say, well, I like it? No, I'm not going to waste my time to do that. So the 20 calls that they take, 15 of them are people complaining, and then they think that's what everybody does, and they freak out, and they change stuff, and it just drives more people away. So hopefully at some point they'll get that fixed.
Yeah, the vocal minority has the power to kill a lot of things. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Eric.
I'm Justin, and remember, we're at TalkBackFanTalk on Twitter. Give us a follow and send us any comments or questions that we can use on the show for our upcoming lightning rounds.
Thanks a lot. Have a good week.